accident, an anomalous event. But two attacking missiles from two separate launch sites rises to the threshold of a coordinated nuclear attack. There can be only one response from the United States, a counterattack aimed at decapitating an enemy who just launched a preemptive nuclear strike. The time has come to turn North Korea into ancient Carthage, into salted earth. Stratcom commander, again over comms. Where is POTUS? Chairman, we need codes. But the president is still in the stairwell, outside the PEOC, on the move. High in space, the advanced, extremely high-frequency satellite constellation is working as designed. But the president's black book remains secured inside the football, swinging from the mill aide's hand. 17 minutes, 30 seconds, the White House, Washington, D.C. The president runs up a set of stairs. Behind him, the vault doors to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center close and lock. Some of the president's advisors have stayed behind. They've read briefings about this kind of scenario and have made peace with what is happening. Like President Carter and President Reagan are said to have decided, they will go down with the ship. The members of the CAT element usher the president down another hallway and through two sets of blast doors, up another stairwell, then another after that, down a corridor, through another set of doors. They are outside the White House now. There is fresh air, green buds on the Jackson magnolia trees, the low hum of helicopter rotor blades. Marine One, ready to take flight. The CAT operators jog with the president across the White House lawn. No green grass yet, just cold, wet earth. 18 minutes, National Military Command Center, Pentagon. Inside the National Military Command Center beneath the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense decides what he should do. An ICBM hurtling toward the United States is about to destroy everything in Washington, D.C. A second ballistic missile en route to the West Coast will detonate somewhere in California or Nevada in minutes. The SecDef knows if he stays where he is, he'll be killed. Even if the hardened walls and ceiling protect him from the initial blast, he will burn to death when the National Military Command Center beneath the Pentagon becomes like a furnace. Former Secretary of Defense William Perry tells us what a Secretary of Defense might be considering in a moment such as this, when there is still time for a SecDef to try to save himself and get out. In this case, if it was a nuclear bomb in Washington, D.C., the cabinet would likely be decapitated, and an emergency government would have to be brought into play, Perry says. An immediate consequence of a nuclear strike would be that democracy would be completely gone and military rule would take place. Perry believes that if military rule is ever imposed on today's America, it would be almost impossible to undo military rule in the United States. The cabinet is the president's principal advisory body. It includes the vice president and the heads of 15 executive departments, as well as the White House chief of staff, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, the director of national intelligence, and a handful of other bureaucrats, just about every one of whom has an office in D.C. It is 3:21 p.m. Federal employees and staff are still hard at work, meaning in a matter of minutes, all of the president's principal advisors will likely be dead. Seeing as many of the president's cabinet members are also named in the line of succession, how power gets passed if the president dies. The best move for the Secretary of Defense is to get out of the Pentagon immediately. According to William Perry, the move would be to get to Raven Rock, and fast. I'd have a discussion with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he says. He'd say, one of us needs to stay, one of us needs to go. Objectively, the wisest move would be for me to try and save myself, Perry explains, because I might end up being the leader of the country. In the presidential line of succession, the Secretary of Defense is number 6. The first 12 are 1. Vice President, 2. Speaker of the House, 3. President pro tempore of the Senate, 4. Secretary of State, 5. Secretary of the Treasury, 6. Secretary of Defense, 7. Attorney General, 8. Secretary of the Interior, 9. Secretary of Agriculture, 10. Secretary of Commerce, 11. Secretary of Labor, 12. Secretary of Health and Human Services. The smart thing for me and the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to do would be to get out, Perry clarifies, to get on a helicopter, to get out of there. If the bomb strikes DC, the first 5 individuals in the presidential line of succession, all of whom are in DC in this scenario, will all almost certainly be killed. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs will almost certainly choose to remain at the Pentagon. My position as Secretary of Defense, Perry continues, would be for me and the vice chairman to be in a secure command post, not inside the Pentagon. Somewhere safe, like Site R. The SecDef's Deputy Chief of Staff speaks on comms with the Pentagon Army heliport, the Pentagon-shaped helicopter pad on the northern side of the building. In order to get there, the SecDef must sprint like a teenager. Meet us in the parking lot, the Deputy Chief of Staff tells Army Heliport Command, a move that will save the Secretary of Defense precious time. Go, the chairman tells the SecDef. You too, he instructs the vice chairman. A nuclear decapitation strike against the Pentagon will upend the National Command Authority, that is, the way presidential authority is exercised and operational command and control is conducted. The chairman knows this, and he does a Dick Cheney. He overrides protocol and takes charge of strategic decisions until the football is reopened and the president is back on comms. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs tells the STRATCOM commander that the president will likely want to use submarine forces in a nuclear counterattack. Submarines are the most survivable leg of the nuclear triad because when electronic communication systems soon fail, submariners will still be able to receive launch orders from STRATCOM using very low frequency, VLF, LF, radio wave technology, developed, rehearsed, and mastered during the Cold War. These subsurface radio systems behave differently from others working in the atmosphere, systems that can easily be destroyed by electromagnetic pulse. The second reason is because submarines cannot easily be located by an enemy force. It's easier to find a grapefruit-sized object in space than a submarine at sea, former Vice Admiral Michael J. Connor, commander of the United States Nuclear Submarine Forces, tells us. And that conversely, anything fixed is destroyable. Launch-on warning policy dictates that now is the time to try to decapitate North Korean leadership before it can launch any more nuclear missiles at the United States. The U.S. submarine force is the fastest way to get missiles on these targets. In preparation for the president's presumed wishes, the USS Nebraska, an Ohio-class, nuclear-armed, nuclear-powered submarine, moves into position out at sea. Far from America's shores, in the vast Pacific Ocean north of the island of Tinian. The SecDef and the vice chairman race to leave the Pentagon. Nuclear war is about to begin. History lesson number 6, nuclear-armed submarines. A nuclear-armed, nuclear-powered submarine is a nightmare weapon system, an object as dangerous to human existence as an incoming asteroid. These submarines are called many things: boomers, vessels of death, nightmare machines, handmaidens of the apocalypse. They are unlocatable and armed to the teeth. Each of the 14 Ohio-class submarines in the U.S. arsenal can empty itself of up to 80 nuclear warheads in a minute and a half and disappear. Russia maintains a fleet of approximate parallel capability. Fearsome and revered, they are masterpieces of engineering. Self-contained ecosystems that generate their own power, make their own oxygen and potable water, and can remain at sea, underwater, almost indefinitely, or until the crew runs out of food. Hidden from reconnaissance satellites, submarines move around the ocean with impunity. Because they have zero detectability, they're immune from first strike attack, or almost any attack, until they're forced to surface upon return to port. Stretching 2 football fields in length, each Ohio-class submarine is capable of launching 20 submarine-launched ballistic missiles, the dreaded SLBMs. 44 feet in length, 83 inches in diameter, and weighing 130,000 pounds at launch, each SLBM is armed with multiple nuclear warheads in its nose cone. The firepower on one of these submarines can pretty much destroy a nation. Nuclear submarine strike capabilities differ from those of land-based ICBMs in significant ways. Because they are undetectable under the sea, they can sneak up very close to a nation's coast and launch a first strike attack, lowering launch to impact time from approximately 30 minutes to a fraction of that. Submarines launch nuclear missiles in unique ways: long range across continents and shorter range by using a depressed, lower trajectory. For example, a Russian sub lurking off the U.S. West Coast can launch its missiles near simultaneously at targets in all 50 states all at once. This is because the multiple warheads in the nose cone of each missile can be deployed to individual targets hundreds of miles away. This is a primary driver of the launch on warning policy and why the U.S. nuclear triad, like Russia's nuclear triad, remains on hair trigger alert. And it is why the president has a 6-minute window to deliberate and decide on a nuclear counterattack. If Washington was attacked by a Russian sub 1,000 kilometers, 621 miles, from our coast, the time of flight would be less than 7 minutes from launch to impact, warns Ted Postol. The president would have no time to escape, and a designated successor would then have to take nuclear command. Back in 1982, in his capacity as advisor to the chief of U.S. naval operations, Postol was asked to give a classified briefing at the Pentagon on the power and speed of an attacking Russian submarine. His briefing slides were hand-drawn. The early personal computers did not have any graphics capabilities, says Postol. The normal method for briefing Pentagon officials back then was for a security-cleared expert to submit slides to the Office of the Draftsman to formalize for presentation. Ted Postal was an exception to the rule. His opinions were highly regarded, and when they were needed fast. Decades later, one of these formerly classified slides, captioned "Near Simultaneous Launch," seems oddly childlike given the Armageddon-like consequences at hand. But the decades-old slide is significant, Postal tells us, because it pointed out that a Soviet submarine can launch all of its missiles at roughly 5-second intervals, unloading all its missiles in about 80 seconds. And each missile has multiple warheads in its nose cone. This fire-to-strike time is so short that if the United States had an attack submarine trailing the Soviet ballistic missile submarine, it could not fire a torpedo in time to sink the submarine before it was empty of missiles. Then, as now, Postal's drawing underscores the reality that there is no defense against a nuclear-armed submarine. And yet, back in 1982, this particular slide managed to stun the very individuals who were in charge of waging submarine warfare at the time. This fact was shocking to the chief of naval operations, Jim Watkins, Postal recalls. He had no idea this was possible. Even crazier, Postal notes, because Watkins himself was a submariner and had certainly been involved in operations where a submarine under his command was shadowing a Soviet ballistic missile submarine. It's the speed with which submarines can launch nuclear weapons that makes them the handmaidens of the apocalypse. In the words of defense analyst Sebastian Roblin, ballistic missile submarines promise the unstoppable hand of nuclear retribution and should deter any sane adversary from attempting a first strike or resorting to nuclear weapons at all. But not all adversaries are sane, as history makes clear. There are those who are like Napoleon, thermonuclear weapons designer Richard Garwin warns, leaders whose mindset echoes, "Après moi, le déluge," after me, the flood. In discussing the rules of nuclear war, Garwin, like former Secretary of Defense Perry, acknowledges that all it takes is one nihilistic madman with a nuclear arsenal to start a nuclear war no one can win. A ruler like the one in this scenario, from North Korea, whose family has managed to rule the country for decades, imposing totalitarian-style martial law and monitoring citizens for the tiniest hint of dissent. In North Korea, any infraction, speaking ill of the leader, leaving a speck of dust on his portrait, wearing skinny jeans, can result in arrest, torture, imprisonment, death. TVs and radios churn out state propaganda. Borders are closed. Ordinary people have little idea of what life outside the hermit kingdom is like. "I had never seen a map of the world," defector Yeonmi Park told Joe Rogan on his podcast. "As an Asian, I did not even know that I was Asian. The regime told me I was a Kim Il-sung race, that the calendar begins when Kim Il-sung was born." Much of the country's landscape is rugged, mountainous terrain. Barely 17% of its land can support basic farming. Crops are said to be fertilized with human excrement. Malnutrition is commonplace. Outside the capital, people forage for grasshoppers and other insects to eat. Livestock is considered property of the state. It is essentially illegal to own a cow. After an undernourished border guard's dramatic 2017 escape was caught on video. Doctors found 10-inch parasitic worms in his intestines. It is as if North Korea's pauperized citizens are deprived of even the tiniest modicum of power, figuratively and literally. When NASA released a satellite image of the Korean Peninsula at night, taken by an Expedition 38 crew member on the International Space Station, bright city lights lit up the southern half of the peninsula, but the northern half was dark. In a caption accompanying the image, NASA wrote, "North Korea is almost completely dark compared to neighboring South Korea and China. The darkened land appears as if it were a patch of water joining the Yellow Sea to the Sea of Japan." While the citizens of North Korea suffer and starve, a succession of its leaders have built for themselves a warren of underground command and control bunkers to keep themselves in power before, during, and after nuclear war, and to avoid decapitation from a strike by the United States. Like other nations, North Korea pursued atomic fission during the Cold War. In the 1990s, it began developing nuclear weapons. By 1994, the CIA told President Clinton North Korea might already have produced one or two nuclear warheads. Clinton dispatched his Secretary of Defense, William Perry, to Pyongyang to try to convince Kim Jong-il to abandon the program in exchange for economic benefits. The result was nil. In 2002, North Korea admitted it had been developing nuclear weapons for years. By 2003, their first reactor was producing weapons-grade plutonium. In 2006, they tested a nuclear bomb. In 2009, they demonstrated a successful second test. By 2016, North Korea had thermonuclear weapons. By 2017, they had engineered an ICBM able to reach anywhere in the world. Augmenting its nuclear arsenal, North Korea maintains an unusual fleet of as many as 80 submarines. If accurate, this means it has one of the largest submarine forces in the world. The U.S. Navy reports having a total of 71. These vessels in North Korea's fleet are old and clunky. Not nuclear-powered, not even close, Postal says. But at least one of them likely can carry a submarine-launched ballistic missile. We know this because in October 2019, North Korea conducted a successful test launch from an underwater platform simulating a submarine launch. And 2 years later, North Korea fired into the open waters off the coast of Japan what was likely an actual submarine-launched ballistic missile. The world's most powerful weapon, the Korean Central News Agency, the state-run news agency of North Korea, declared. And one submarine-launched ballistic missile is all a mad king requires. While experts disagree on whether a North Korean submarine could realistically sneak up close to the U.S. and launch a missile, Garwin says unlikely, Ted Postal maintains it most certainly could. It would be a tricky operation, he says, but not impossible. I've done some analysis. I wouldn't rule it out. Postal's calculations go like this. North Korea's diesel submarine in this scenario is a modified 1950s-era attack submarine of the Romeo class. These diesel-electric submarines are really hard to find in the ocean, he affirms, except when they recharge their batteries. Then they're vulnerable. A diesel-electric submarine gets its power from a diesel motor, which drives electric generators and charges its batteries. When the submarine wants to be covert, Postal notes, the submarine operates only on batteries, and it's under the surface, and it's an electric-powered system, so it's very quiet. Eventually, batteries run down and need to be recharged. For this, a diesel engine needs air. And to explain how this works, Postal puts himself in the shoes of a North Korean submariner. So what I do is I get up close to the surface and I extend up to the water surface a device that's called a snorkel, basically a pipe, typically with a hat on top of it to protect against waves. And at the same time, I keep it low to the water. You don't want the pipe up too high. Modern radar systems are pretty able to see things like a snorkel sticking above the water. The submariner would have to travel very slowly. Slowly as in about 5 knots. This is because most battery power consumed by a diesel-electric submarine is for hotel load, meaning keeping people warm, fans blowing to keep the oxygen generating. Postal surmises that in a primitive submarine like this, one that doesn't have the most advanced batteries, you could probably stay underwater for 72 to 96 hours, going at 5 knots, before you have to snorkel. And to give us a sense of how much power the vessel would consume if going fast, if you're going at 25 knots, your power is gone in less than 1 hour, so you've got to be slow. But if you are a North Korean submariner, you're pretty tough, Postal imagines. He calculates. So, say I can do 100 hours at a time, at 5 knots without having to snorkel, to surface and recharge the batteries. That means I can cover about 500 nautical miles between snorkeling events, if I'm careful and quiet. Difficult, but not impossible. If I were a North Korean submariner, I'd snorkel for a couple of hours and try to make sure that nobody sees me, which is not hard to do because there's a lot of ocean out there. So let's say the transit is 5 or 6,000 nautical miles. So it's a couple of months. And you need a lot of food. You probably don't expect to make it home. But if you're North Korean, that's part of the job. Postal also worked out the route. If you wanted to pose a threat to the United States, you would try to hug the southern coast of Alaska, he suggests, citing the underwater geography involved. You want to stay on the continental shelf in shallow water, which is not so shallow that a submarine can't use it, because if you go into the deep water, there's a good chance we'll find you, because the sound of the snorkeling submarine in deep water is potentially detectable at hundreds of miles. The detectability of submarines is not simply how noisy they are, Postal asserts. It is what is going on in whatever kind of environment they are operating in, a concept known as the echo effect, which Postal has spent hours not just thinking about, but explaining to officials at the Pentagon. When a submarine is in shallow water, it is nearly impossible to hear it, even with a very advanced acoustic system. An advanced sonar system like SOSIS, Sound Surveillance System, developed by the U.S. Navy during the Cold War to track Soviet submarines and create its strategy for anti-submarine warfare. SOSIS has advanced over the years. It's how, in June 2023, the Navy was able to hear an underwater implosion that was likely the Titan submersible. But SOSIS works in deep ocean waters, not shallow waters. And the reason it's nearly impossible to detect has to do with the complexity of the signals from reflections off the ocean's surface and bottom, the echo chamber effect. In shallow water, says Postal, there are too many echoes. You can't hear or see shit. In this scenario, North Korea's diesel-electric Romeo-class submarine crosses the ocean, hugs the continental shelf along Alaska, then head south. And suddenly, you find yourself off the coast of the United States and able to strike with the short-range ballistic missile. That is the scenario we're looking at now. It is how the North Korean Navy managed to get a ballistic missile submarine within striking distance of the west coast of the United States. And now, 18 minutes after the Hwasong-17 ICBM first launched, a nuclear-capable, submarine-launched, short-range ballistic missile has emerged from the ocean. It ends powered flight and begins mid-course phase. Tracking data indicates that it is headed toward the middle to bottom half of California, population 25 million souls. 19 minutes, Aerospace Data Facility, Colorado. At the Aerospace Data Facility in Colorado, analysts with NRO, NSA, and Space Force all see the data at the same time. They all understand that there is now a second ballistic missile attacking the United States. This one, flying at a speed of Mach 6 or 4,600 miles per hour, on a quasi-ballistic trajectory, appears to be headed for Southern California or maybe Nevada. It is less than 300 miles away from the shore. The missile is the KN-23, a North Korean short-range ballistic missile similar to the one that analysts watched successfully fire from a subsurface platform off the coast of Sinpo in October 2021. The intended purpose of the KN-23, analysts believed back then, was to deliver a nuclear weapon to a target in South Korea. Now, one of them is flying towards Southern California, moving at a rate of 6 times the speed of sound. The KN-23 is roughly 25 feet long and has fins. Its operational range is somewhere between 280 and 430 miles, depending on the payload. It can carry in its nose cone a 1,100-pound warhead. But the target that the KN-23 nuclear missile is headed for will be utterly catastrophic, no matter the yield. The target is protected by Article 15 of the Geneva Conventions, a set of treaties and protocols that form the core of international humanitarian law and regulate the conduct of armed conflict. But as the world is about to learn, there are no laws in nuclear war. The premise of deterrence is that nuclear war is never supposed to happen. The Aerospace Data Facility alerts military commands in Nebraska, Colorado, and Washington, D.C. With all U.S. military forces at DEFCON 1, all personnel at all 11 combatant commands in the United States and around the world are already poised for imminent nuclear battle. Confirmation of this second attacking missile ratchets up the degree of force that will be used in the U.S. counterattack. Because of the missile's low apogee, high point, its short flight time, and the maneuverability from its fins, the Defense Department faces an unmitigated nightmare. The KN-23 missile is capable of evading traditional U.S. missile defense, and a launch-to-target distance of less than 400 miles, traveling at a speed of Mach 6, means the missile will remain in the air for less than 3 minutes. 20 minutes, U.S. Strategic Command Headquarters, Nebraska. Duty officers at Stratcom's battle deck in Nebraska receive sensor data from the Aerospace Data Facility in Colorado, confirming launch and travel time. Based on plume measurements and missile trajectory, This second attacking ballistic missile is heading into Southern California or possibly lower Nevada. Likely targets include China Lake, the Naval Air Weapons Station near Inyokern, Fort Irwin, the Army garrison in the Mojave Desert, Naval Base Coronado, the Pacific Fleet's home port off San Diego, Nellis Air Force Base, the Air Force installation in southern Nevada. On satellite comms, all commanders wait for the president's orders, as he is still in the process of being evacuated by CAT operators onto Marine One. As tracking data comes in, Nuclear Command and Control computing systems calculate and project the target more accurately. The missile now appears to be heading toward Vandenberg Space Force Base, roughly 50 miles northwest of Santa Barbara. Machine analysis is never perfect, and the missile has fins that can change its trajectory at any time. Seconds pass. As it turns out, the algorithmic estimation is off by some 35 miles. The target is up the coast from Vandenberg Space Force Base. The target is a civilian facility on an ocean bluff just north of Avila Beach, California. The target is the Diablo Canyon Power Plant, a nuclear power plant with 2,000-plus megawatt pressurized water reactors. 21 minutes. Diablo Canyon Power Plant, San Luis Obispo County, California. The incoming short-range ballistic missile races toward Diablo Canyon Power Plant, a 750-acre facility sitting 85 feet above the Pacific Ocean. It is a warm day at the end of March, 12:24 p.m. local time, the hour that security guards at Diablo's southern-facing gate are generally known to eat lunch, often outside in the sun. There are seagulls resting along the tops of fence poles here. Pelicans are visible on the beach below, catching prey in their large throat pouches and swallowing fish whole. It is near to low tide. Seaweed covers the rocks. As of 2024, Diablo is the only nuclear power plant in California that remains active. The gate guard here, eating his lunch in the sun, is one of some 1,200 employees and 200 subcontractors who work on site at Diablo. None of them has any idea that in just a few seconds they will all be cremated on the spot. To defend against short-range ballistic missiles, the U.S. Navy has developed its Aegis program, an anti-ballistic missile system mounted on Navy Aegis cruisers and destroyers at sea. Unlike the faulty interceptor program, Aegis missiles have a shoot-down record of 85%. But these battleships are out on patrol in the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans and in the Persian Gulf, defending America's NATO and Indo-Pacific partners from attack. They are thousands of miles away from being anywhere near shooting range of America's west coast. The Pentagon also operates a land-based missile defense program called the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD system, one that fires anti-ballistic missiles from launchers mounted on flatbed trucks. But as with the Aegis missile defense systems, all of America's THAAD systems are presently deployed overseas. Years back, after North Korea first successfully fired a KN-23 missile, Congress discussed setting up THAAD systems along America's west coast, but as of 2024, has not done so yet. In this moment, all of these missile defense systems are a moot point. The SBIRS space satellites spotted the hot rocket exhaust on this sub-launched missile just a fraction of a second after launch. But now, roughly 4 minutes have passed. Boost phase and mid-course phase have begun and ended. The warhead bearing down on the Diablo Canyon power plant now enters terminal phase. In the laws of war, there exists a promise among nations never to attack a nuclear reactor. Expanding on the Geneva Convention's Protocol 2, Article 15, the International Committee of the Red Cross calls this Rule 42. Practice relating to Rule 42, works and installations containing dangerous forces. Section A, Additional Protocol 2. Article 15 of the 1977 Additional Protocol 2 provides, nuclear electrical generating stations shall not be made the object of attack, even where these objectives are military objectives. But as history demonstrates, mad rulers disobey rules of war. In words often attributed to Adolf Hitler, if you win, you need not have to explain. Directly attacking a nuclear reactor with a nuclear-armed missile is a worst-case scenario beyond measure. In terms of outcome, there are few nuclear attack realities that can get any worse. Nuclear weapons exploded in the air, at sea, and on land create varying degrees of radiation and fallout based on yield, size of explosion, and weather, rain versus wind. Radiation let loose in the atmosphere dissipates over time, rising into the troposphere and moving with the wind. But attacking a nuclear reactor with a nuclear missile all but guarantees a core reactor meltdown that in turn results in a thousands of years long nuclear catastrophe. What is about to happen in Southern California is known by energy officials as the devil's scenario, a phrase also used in secret discussions led by the Japan Atomic Energy Commission chairman, Dr. Shunsuke Kondo, and others after the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant disaster of 2011. In that case, after the plant's 6 nuclear reactors were catastrophically impacted by a magnitude 9.0 earthquake and a 46-foot-tall tsunami wave, the plant suffered major damage and officials feared the worst. During a closed-door emergency meeting, Japan's cabinet members acknowledged that Fukushima Daiichi was on the brink of core reactor meltdown and hydrogen fire if they were unable to get its cooling system back online. Were this to happen, a blanket of dense radioactive smoke would spread out across eastern Japan, rendering a 150-mile stretch of land from Fukushima to Tokyo impassable to humans for an untold number of years. That was the devil's scenario that was on my mind, Japan's chief cabinet secretary, Yukio Idano, later explained, and that he feared common sense dictated that if that came to pass, then it was the end of Tokyo, as in the entire city. But Japan was spared. 3 of the 6 nuclear reactors at Fukushima Daiichi sustained severe core damage and released radioactive materials, but they did not melt down. The devil's scenario did not come to pass. Japan dodged a bullet, wrote Declan Butler in Nature magazine. In its 2014 report called Reflections on Fukushima, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission warned that what happened in Japan should serve the world as a cautionary tale. All nuclear power plants generate electric power using heat from enriched uranium. Every 5 years, each plant's spent nuclear fuel rods lose their full capacity and must be removed, stored, and kept cool. these rods remain highly radioactive for thousands of years. At Diablo Canyon, there are more than 2,500 spent fuel assemblies being continually cooled in on-site cooling pools, which use water from the Pacific Ocean. Were these pumps to fail by accident or by attack, a catastrophic meltdown would occur. Every 3 years, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission carries out force-on-force maneuvers where security guards practice how to counter a direct attack. Exercises include tabletop games like chess and mock drills that simulate combat against an adversary force like a terrorist organization. But there has never been such a thing as a rehearsal against an incoming nuclear missile. This is because no such defense exists. Rule 42, like the concept of deterrence, is psychological. A theoretical supposition predicated on supposed future behavior and follow-on consequences that promise to work until it doesn't work. 58 miles up, the nuclear warhead from the submarine-launched ballistic missile re-enters the atmosphere, traveling now at a speed of more than 4,000 miles per hour. 30 seconds remain until the bomb's triggering system is set to explode. A Nuclear Regulatory Commission report finds that a small to medium-sized fire at a facility like Diablo Canyon would displace 3 to 4 million people. We'd be talking about trillion-dollar consequences, Frank von Hippel, professor emeritus at Princeton University and co-founder of its program on science and global security, said of such a catastrophe. But a nuclear strike against Diablo Canyon power plant will not produce a fire that is small or even medium-sized. It will be a radioactive inferno, the beginning of the apocalypse. 20 seconds remain. A nuclear strike against a nuclear reactor guarantees a nuclear core collapse, also known as a nuclear core materials meltdown. In an article from the New York Times, published in 1971, former Manhattan Project physicist Ralph E. Lapp described what happens were a nuclear reactor to experience a core collapse. Citing facts from the Atomic Energy Commission's Irgun report, Lapp detailed the horror, first an explosion, then fire, then the uncontrollable spewing out of radioactive debris. But what happens deep inside the reactor core is the real threat, Lapp explained. This molten debris could accumulate at the bottom of the reactor vessel. A huge, molten, radioactive mass would sink into the earth and continue to grow in size for about 2 years. A high-temperature mass, a liquefied hot sphere of radioactive lava and smoldering fire, about 100 feet in diameter, might form and persist for a decade. 4, 3, 2, 1. The KN-23's nuclear warhead detonates on its target. The entire Diablo nuclear power plant is consumed in a flash of nuclear light. There is a massive fireball, a building-destroying blast, a nuclear mushroom cloud, and a nuclear core meltdown. The devil's scenario has come to pass. 22 minutes. Cavalier Space Force Station, North Dakota. The Cavalier Space Force Station in eastern North Dakota sits 15 miles from the Canadian border. Here, inside an 8-story tall concrete structure, a massive, octagon-shaped radar system scans the sky. Given Cavalier's position on the globe, its radar sees the attacking warhead let loose by the Hwasong 17 ICBM as it comes over the horizon in mid-course phase from the north. This occurs approximately 22 minutes after launch. The ground radar's observation will be the last over-the-horizon tracking data the Space Force records before the bomb detonates over DC. 10 or 11 minutes remain. There is now enough data to pinpoint the target within a half-mile distance. The target is either the Pentagon or the White House. What is happening in this scenario is a decapitation event. 23 minutes, the White House, Washington, D.C. In Washington, D.C., the president gets strapped into Marine One, its rotor blades spinning, ready for ascent. It has been several minutes since the president climbed inside, and yet the helicopter still hasn't left. The special agent in charge of the president's detail is screaming at the president's national security advisor, who is yelling into his own cell phone while standing in the doorway of Marine One. The SAC is about to get physical. It's his duty to protect the president with his own life. SAC, helicopter needs to leave now. The fierce argument between the two men has been over the available number of parachutes in Marine One. The controversy has wasted precious time. The three-man counter-assault team element has shoots for themselves, for the president, for the special agent in charge, and for the mill aide, the sum total of parachutes in the Secret Service's White House office was 6. There are 14 people in Marine One, meaning the rest of the passengers will go down with the aircraft if it goes down. The national security advisor gives up the fight. He decides to take his chances, gets into the helicopter, and straps in. Already inside are a few individuals from the executive office of the president, sometimes called the permanent government, including the national cyber director and the executive secretary of the National Space Council. The White House chief of staff, the assistant to the president for homeland security and counterterrorism, and half a dozen others are running toward a second Marine helicopter ready to lift off from farther down the lawn. The Marine One fleet is reinforced with ballistic armor, has anti-missile defense, and a missile warning threat system. As the newly built Sikorsky VH-92A carrying the president and his advisors begins to rise, CAT operators up and down the White House lawn scan for threats. But the threat is not coming from the ground. The threat is approaching from above. Only minutes remain until a nuclear bomb will strike Washington, D.C. Inside Marine One, multiple people are shouting at the president over satellite video comms displayed in front of him. The president's family, his wife, and their children are in upstate New York with his in-laws. The SecDef and the vice chairman are en route to Site R. The vice president's whereabouts have yet to be confirmed. A system of antennas and satellite dishes contained in a communications bubble attached to the helicopter's tail boom has the president connected with STRATCOM. Nuclear Command Control and Communications, or NC3, is a complex system of systems that exist on the ground, in the air, and in space. Its components include receivers, terminals, and satellites to keep the nuclear triad under the president's control. The NC3 system inside Marine One is said to be hardened against the electromagnetic pulse that accompanies a nuclear flash. But no one has any idea if the system will endure or fall apart in a nuclear war. When analyzing its efficiency in 2021, the Government Accountability Office did not make public its recommendations, and the Defense Department did not comment. Seated next to the president, The mill aide opens the football, inside of which is the black book. As the helicopter leaves the White House complex airspace, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff speaks first over comms. "Chairman, we've been hit with a nuclear bomb in California." "Jesus Christ, didn't we have a few more minutes?" the president asks. National Security Advisor: "A second missile." He stumbles. "A different one." Chairman: "In Southern California, at a nuclear power plant." Stratcom Commander: "We anticipate the Pentagon will be hit next, sir." The National Security Advisor points to a time clock on an electronic screen inside Marine One, counting down seconds. Chairman: "Launch orders, sir." The president removes the laminated code card from his wallet, the biscuit with the gold codes. "Chairman, advising Option Charlie from the Black Book, sir." Just minutes from now, the chairman will be dead. The president confirms Option Charlie, a nuclear counterstrike designed as the launch-on warning response to a North Korean nuclear strike against America. 82 targets, or aim points, that include North Korea's nuclear and WMD facilities, its leadership, and other war-sustaining facilities. This counterstrike launches 50 Minuteman III ICBMs and 8 Trident SLBMs. Each Trident carries 4 nuclear warheads in its nose cone, for a total of 82 nuclear warheads at 82 targets on the northern half of the Korean Peninsula. This motherload of force is but a fraction of what the original PSYOP for nuclear war called for in its opening salvo against Moscow. Here, in this scenario, the 82 nuclear warheads about to be launched all but guarantee the deaths of millions of people, or maybe even tens of millions of people, on the Korean Peninsula alone. It is nearly noiseless inside Marine One. Speaking in a normal tone, the president reads the nuclear launch codes out loud. 23 minutes, 30 seconds, National Military Command Center, Pentagon. Beneath the Pentagon, the Deputy Director of Operations authenticates as fact that the man who just ordered a nuclear counterstrike against North Korea is the President of the United States. This is not done by state-of-the-art voice print biometrics, but rather the old-school way, by challenge and response code, two letters from the NATO phonetic alphabet spoken by a human voice. Foxtrot Tango, the deputy director of operations, says in this scenario, these are the last two words he will ever say to the president. From inside Marine One, the president reads his response. "Yankee Zulu," he says. As the helicopter leaves the White House complex airspace, the president stares out the window of Marine One, watching as the distance between himself and the city expands. The end of the world has been set in motion by two code words spoken aloud. 24 minutes. Missile Alert Facility, Wyoming. 1,600 miles from Washington, D.C., in a field in Wyoming, a patch of hard-packed snow shimmers in the afternoon sun. There is chain-link fence, motion detection equipment, and a 110-ton concrete door lying flush with the earth, facing the sky. To passers-by, this is cowboy country, rancher's land. To Strategic Command, it's ICBM silo country, home to one-third of the nation's 400 land-based nuclear missiles. To those not in the know, The Echo 01 launch facility in this scenario is simply a nondescript cluster of buildings, house, barn, electric tower, garage. But beneath the blast doors, hidden in the field, sits an 80-foot-deep missile silo tunnel with concrete walls that are 4 feet thick. An elevator shaft